The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Robots and Drones by Lorenz Baker. No, the storm didn't catch me on the interstate unawares. Yes. I'm prepared, maybe, but I'm home. We won't be boarding up windows and hitting the highway under a mandatory excavation. I would have noticed a tornado or hurricane warning, but this wind, there will be tree arms scattered throughout the yard, and up and down sidewalks, pines, dogwoods, and great oaks will be toppled on every other block. A walk to the main road told the tale of the nightmare that was the carnage on Cedar Lane, the disaster on Aspen Drive, the train wreck behind Arbor Glen, literally, and Redwood Lane. I'd like to, but it would be in my best interest not to venture up Redwood. The oak tree near the corner grabbed power lines on the way down. I decided I could do without the scorching of an extra 240 volts. And the way the water rushed like a waterfall on Redwood, no doubt a pipe burst. It'll be ice by morning, and then Mockingbird Lane. There's no 1313 on Mockingbird. The numbers don't go that high. A new subdivision, only a few homes built so far. The house at the end of the cul-de-sac looks a lot like the Munsters' home from the television show. The family's cane corso could double as Eddie Munster's pet spot. When it's all said and done, it will be a county-wide disaster and possibly statewide. So far, windows are blown in at schools, small businesses in the square flooded, roofs ripped off of factories. Word is it spawned a quick tornado, the storm, that is. Hail damage to new car lots. Gale-force winds delivered uppercuts, a right cross that buckles your knees. An elbow to the back of the head, yeah, that's the one we didn't see coming. The 40-year-old 100-foot oak that we thought would stand forever toppled through the middle of the square, crushing a handful of businesses on top of the wind and water damage. Allow me to start from the beginning. It was a dark and stormy night. Cliché, my sentiments exactly, but that's how the evening started. The heavy rain came suddenly, landing like an invading army, pelting the windows and deck. Then the power went out and a bolt of lightning turned the stormy night to day. The clap of thunder, though a handful of seconds behind, seemed like an eternity before it arrived, and our house shook so we felt it would be blown apart. The wind picked up with every moment that passed. Before the sun went down, it was 57 degrees and a light breeze blew leaves across the front yard and the driveway. The tops of the trees swayed, the wind a haunting saxophone, its selection Ray Charles's Hard Times. The temperature dropped 30 degrees in 50 minutes. The last time it did this, sleet, rain, and snow made my ride home from work a nightmare. We slipped and slid in spite of the early warning and the salt being applied to the roads. There were so many people on the highways and back roads creeping along at such a slow pace it would have taken 3 hours to travel my usually 20-minute trek. It hadn't snowed in decades. And so the cleanup came. But it was different this time. With other cleanups, you would see a dozen power trucks lining the road here and another dozen lining the road there. Somewhere else, you'd see county workers removing the fallen trees and fixing a busted water main, plus clearing debris from sewer openings to help the water run free and fast from the streets. But this time around, drones blazed up and down the streets above the tree line, and then more drones blazed through the wooded areas behind our homes and in the parks, and also through the streets leading to the town square. When I got to the area along the streets where debris was blocking the sewer, or where large tree branches had fallen on wires, or where the top half of trees had been snapped in half, I found more drones. Not like the small ones that were speeding around town above the tree line and under the tree line through the wooded areas, but drones the size of dump trucks with robots sawing the large branches and robots sawing to completely separate the top of the trees that had been snapped like matchsticks but hung perilously, threatening to crush anyone that might pass underneath. My early morning run or mid-afternoon bike ride could end up causing me to lose more than just a cup of sweat and a handful of pounds. As I continued assessing the carnage from the storm, I think, I'm open to change or progression, if you will. Why not a handful of drones flying around to assess the situation? Almost everyone has them. The police, the delivery companies, and a park on a given day is filled with just as many drones as there are bicycles. But when did the county, the power companies, and the police department start making use of so many robots? There is not a human in sight. The worker in the bucket of the power company drone truck, robot. The workers clearing the sewer grid, robots. The worker sawing the top of the trees that fell to the ground during the storm, robots. The bulldozer and or bobcats grabbing loose debris floated 3 to 5 feet above the sidewalk and were and are operated by robots. No sooner did I think, well, where's the shredder or wood chipper, did 5 more drone trucks clear the tree line above me. 3 descended into place behind the other equipment and hovered 3 feet above the pavement like the others. Attached to one was the wood chipper. The other 2 drone trucks continued on, likely to the park and the town square. These new arrivals weren't from the county. There was no county logo on the sides of these drones, nor on the uniforms of the robots I could see as they jumped to the ground. Robots and drones, machines everywhere. Where are the human beings, the men, the women? Likely these robots are the first responders now, and the government has it set up so that human beings can be with their families and then come in and work with the robots and drones, creating a more focused, stronger, and efficient task force. I was so busy taking in the scene, I never noticed the robot officers that had moved on my position and were now standing behind me and next to me. "Sir, please move back down the street behind the barrier. We need to cordon off the parkway all the way through town," stated the officer. As I turned to walk toward the barrier, 3 enormous drones hovered near the end of the parkway that intersected with the street connecting the neighborhood in which I live. At first glance, I counted what looked to be 12 robot soldiers that emerged from the first large drone and maybe 10 to 12 from the other 2 drones. "To protect and serve," I thought, as a container emerged from the rear drone with what looked like more than a dozen wrecked assault rifles. "To protect and serve. I hope so, because this has the makings of an invasion." A Matter of Degrees by Bob Fasiszewski. Residents of the Northern Hemisphere normally welcome the chance to throw off their layers of winter clothing and romp with as little attire as possible in the world's lakes and oceans. They didn't realize that during this particular year, the sun they so fervently wished could become the instrument of their destruction. As Mother Nature began to close the curtain on 2300, she decided to play a cruel joke on humanity by having the sun shine continuously 24 hours a day. Medical personnel working in emergency rooms across most of the civilized world failed to get punchline. They couldn't find humor in the fact that the third-degree sunburn cases began to overwhelm hospitals across the globe, and they feared that death toll records soon would follow. Amazingly, most of the patients received their burns from only a half-hour exposure in the middle of November, when the majority of the hemisphere usually began hunkering down for winter. The epicenter of the weird climate reversal? The normally most frigid inhabited place on Earth? Omayakon, Russia? This area had sent a record of negative 153 degrees Fahrenheit in 1933. Its daily temperature in the penultimate month of 2300 had averaged positive 120 degrees Fahrenheit for a solid week. Even though the overall temperature of the entire Earth had increased, only 1 degree every 6 months, the world's top climate scientists at first seemed unconcerned. As the illnesses and death piled up, the dire consequences that could loom for the planet begin to hit home. The scientists also saw signs that oceans around the globe soon could dry up, putting even the most plentiful water supplies in danger. Even though leaders outside Omicron saw the possibility of disaster mounting in their own countries, the effects for the time being were small. Politicians being politicians, therefore, continued to put off taking united and concerted action. The cruel reality hit those working in the gold rich mines around Omicron long before the scientists. Normally accustomed to laboring at full tilt in gold mines for a maximum of 5 hours a day in the most intolerable cold, they now began to faint after an hour of minimum effort. Hundreds of workers filled every available ambulance as emergency medical services transported victims to the district's hospital to prevent their deaths from sun poisoning. Demetrius, the 10-year foreman of the most rugged mining crew in the district, saw no alternative but to call a halt to the largest extraction operation in this area because he feared all of his crew members might eventually perish in the explosion of solar heat. Mining company executives and government officials alike began breathing down the neck of Demetrius to increase his production. But they, too, saw the devastation mounting not only in their offices, but in their own homes, as one person after another fell victim to the unbearable heat. Dr. Ivan Makalevich, head dermatologist in the district's hospital, tried desperately to find a treatment for the apparently incurable sunburn that wreaked havoc on the bodies of every man, woman, and child in a region where the overwhelming sickness for centuries had been frostbite. Due to their many years of experience, he and his colleagues had learned to deal with the results of living in the most frigid conditions in the world, but this heat and its resulting burns were an entirely different animal. The pressures on Demetrius and Dr. Malevich paled in comparison to those on Dr. Igor Frederick, Russia's chief meteorological expert. He kept pushing his subskeleton staff down to almost nil from the mysterious sunburn illness to their limits to discover a cause for the startling reversal in their normally extremely cold climate. But none of them had ever seen anything like this, and they saw no possibility for a solution to the crisis in the near future, making the situation more dire. Centuries of international aggression by Russia against many of its former client states had caused support for investment for a global-backed rescue operation to become nearly non-existent. Also, the remainder of the nations on Earth, whose leaders felt considerably less threatened by the developing crisis, didn't see an urgent need to risk scarce resources to prop up a nation that possibly might turn against them in the future. Leaders outside Russia also believed that if the crisis kept expanding in the nations with normally more moderate climates, the road to a solution would come much easier for them than it would for Omicron, which had much longer and complicated summit to reach. Dimitris saw himself and his family in a hopeless situation, with his country's top experts apparently with no solution to the crisis, and the rest of the world apparently shrugging its shoulders at the possible coming extinction of his homeland. The only path all these experts left open to the gold mine foreman was to get out as soon as he, his family, and close friends could before getting trampled in the stampede of those fleeing what eventually could be the end of the world. Dimitris scoured the internet for an alternative to what most certainly pointed to the coming of the destruction of his homeland and probably the apocalypse for the entire Earth. His research brought him to an article on scientificamerican.com about exploration of a newly discovered planet, Hucheron. Apparently this planet had a climate and atmosphere very similar to that of Earth, and it existed only a day's travel time via space vehicles available to Russians of the socioeconomic level of Dimitris in the dawn of the 25th century. In addition, he had won a doctorate in cyber technology prior to pursuing gold mining, which he had seen as a more rapid path to great wealth. He now tapped into his educational background to build an intergalactic communications system. Although reaching out to the distant planet proved extremely challenging because of the outdated Hucheron technology, he managed to establish relations with the governing council of the planet Hucheron and paved the way for the future domicile for himself and his family. The Hucheronians also saw an alliance with Dimitris as their best opportunity to tap into Earth's more advanced gold mining technology in order to more easily open their own substantial gold reserves. Hucheron's outdated mining methods had left these reserves untouched for more than 50 years. Although the Stone Age Hucheron technology made a return trip to Earth impossible for the present, Dimitris saw this alliance as his only hope. He plotted his course for Hucheron and prepared his crew for the intergalactical voyage and swore those in his small circle to top secrecy. No use tipping off the rest of the world and causing a massive exodus and panic that could sabotage their voyage. Finally, the day of the voyage came and Dimitris and his crew took off for their new world. As their space vehicle cleared Earth's atmosphere, they looked back in horror as the only world they had ever known exploded into a huge black hole in the vast darkness of space. Dimitris and his family believed their new dream in Hucheron would offer them a new and exciting opportunity, as vast as the area of space between their extinct planet and their new solar system. Me and Hector by John Jones. It was so terribly cold. Snow was falling and it was almost dark. It wasn't supposed to be that way. When Hector and I started our hike, the cold was beginning to bother me, but Hector probably thought it was paradise. For Alaskan Malamutes, the colder the better. Mals are big dogs and Hector was on the large side of big. Look, Hector is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Mouths were bred to pull heavy loads, so brain power wasn't a requirement. But he is a damn good dog and a better friend. Loyal and affectionate, Hector is the most zen being I have ever met. Steady as a rock and completely unflappable. Yeah, I know, Hector is a weird name for a dog, much less a Mal. When we first got him 5 years ago and were trying to decide on a name, we threw all sorts of names his way. He was only 8 weeks old and completely ignored every single one until I said, Hector. He immediately came over to me. Probably a total coincidence, but it stuck. Maybe you noticed I said we got him. It's just me now. I'm in my early 30s and a widower. Callie, my wife of 8 years, died in a car accident caused by a DUI driver 2 years ago. Hector and I are still a mess. He was Callie's fur baby, and they were very close. He still sleeps with one of her shirts, so don't tell me that dogs don't grieve. We started coming out on these long hikes as therapy for both of us. The insurance settlement from her death meant I didn't need to work full-time, which was good since I was in no condition to be working around power lines and transformers. Mostly, Hector and I hung out, and when winter came, we took a lot of hikes since he wasn't fond of summer. The forecast said cold and clear. As usual, the weather person got it wrong. I was dressed for cold and clear, but not for terribly cold and snowing. Hector didn't care in the slightest. It should have been no big deal, right? Just head back to the SUV. But this was a new area for us, and my GPS kept looping up in circles until I was completely lost in an area I didn't know. Then the temperature plummeted, the light began to fade, and it started snowing. Not much at first, but it was coming down heavy now. I briefly considered that Hector might find the way back, but he was having the time of his life and had no idea we were lost. The snow turned the woods into a winter wonderland. If I'd known where we were and it hadn't started getting dark, it might have been beautiful. The snow threw a blanket of quiet over the woods, and the bitter cold drove every living thing to shelter. Every living thing except Hector and I. I checked my phone again. No service. Worry started sinking in. Hector could curl up and sleep through it until morning if he had to. I didn't have that luxury. All right, boy, let's get moving. Let's try this direction, I told him. We walked maybe 50 feet before Hector stopped, turned, and stared off in a completely different direction. Come on, Hector, let's go. He ignored me. I trudged over to him and crouched down in the deepening snow. Buddy, we can't stay here. We gotta keep moving. No reaction. He just continued to stare off. I could see his nose twitching like he was smelling something. On the faint chance that maybe he knew where to go, I gave in. All right, let's try your way. He walked a short distance, stopped, sniffed again, and then let out a long howl. Mals don't bark much, but they vocalize constantly. Most male owners swear they're trying to talk, and like their wolf cousins, they seem driven to howl. What is it, boy? Maybe we weren't the only ones out here. He suddenly took off through the deepening snow. Hector is pure muscle with endless endurance, and he could have left me far behind in seconds. Hector, stay, I yelled. He stopped, thank God, and looked back at me like he'd forgotten I existed. Slow down, wait for me. He gave a short hurruff and waited for me to catch up. Still sniffing, his short ears were turning like little radar dishes as he tracked whatever had caught his attention. I quickly clipped his leash on and we started off again. He pulled like a sled dog hauling freight. Hector had four-wheel drive. I had two long, awkward stilts. While he had no problem moving through the snowy woods in the dim light, easily ducking under branches and fallen trees, I had to constantly pull him back in, and I tried to keep from running headlong into something. The exercise had warmed me up, but the temperature kept dropping, and my extremities were starting to go numb. The snow was falling even heavier now, and darkness was setting in fast. If Hector didn't lead us somewhere soon, or if he was wrong, I was going to be in serious trouble. Maybe a mile later, I smelled smoke. We pushed through a stand of large white pine, and Hector suddenly stopped. To my disbelief, a cabin stood in a small clearing ahead. I stared. Hector had smelled the smoke from a mile away. Maybe heard the fire burning, too. I had to be right on top of it before I did. Human senses are pitiful next to dogs. "Good boy," I said, leaning down to pet him. At that very moment, he lunged forward, yanking the leash out of my hand, face first in the snow. I pushed myself up to my knees. "Okay, that hurt," I muttered, rubbing my rapidly numbing face. His normally zen dog was losing his mind. Jumping and prancing on the front porch, he raced back, grabbed my arm, and tried to pull me to the cabin, sending me face first into the snow again. "Jeez, Hector, back up." I gingerly got to my feet, staying clear of my suddenly unhinged dog. I followed him to the door. I knocked. No answer, but I could hear the fire crackling. I pushed the handle down. The door opened an inch, and Hector hit it like a linebacker, barreling inside and dragging me with him. Stumbling forward, I nearly face-planted for the third time. The cabin was one room, rustic with mismatched furniture. The kitchen cabinets were barely holding on to the wall, but it was warm. A roaring fire had the place toasty. A very welcome miracle, and it was empty. Hector tore around the room, confused and upset that he couldn't find anyone. The back door opened and he whipped around. A small figure, bundled head to toe, came in carrying firewood. I swear Hector's eyes got as big as saucers. One second he was beside me, the next he was on his hind legs, paws on the figure's shoulders. Hector wrestled them to the floor as the firewood was sent flying. He shoved his nose into the figure's hood, whimpering and crying. The figure laughed. Arms went around Hector's neck in a hug. "My beautiful fur baby." I froze solid. As solid as if I had been out in these woods all night. The last time I heard that voice was 2 years ago, when she said she was running to the store and would be back soon. She untangled herself from Hector and stood. Her hood fell back. Callie smiled at me. "Hey," she said softly. My legs quit on me. I dropped to my hands and knees, hyperventilating. A gloved hand touched my cheek, then helped me to my feet. "Easy, big boy," Callie said. "Slow breaths." She hugged me. I couldn't move. My brain was complete mush. "I've finally lost it," was all I could mutter. She laughed. "You haven't lost it, sweetie." "How can this be? I mean, how can this be?" I asked twice because asking it once didn't even scratch the surface. Callie stepped back, petting Hector while looking me up and down. "You look good." "Not so good. I've missed you so much. How are you here?" "We never got a chance to say goodbye. I never got to say goodbye to Hector either. I couldn't leave it like that, and I needed to talk to you." I was crying. I'm not even sure when I started. Her arms were back around me, her gloved hand wiping the tears from my face. "We've been struggling, Callie," I said. "Both of us. He looks for you every day. He thinks it's you every time a door opens." I hesitated. "So do I." I know. It's why I came. I really miss you guys, but I'm okay. Don't worry about me. I want you to be happy, to move on. It's okay to let me go. Keep taking care of one another, okay? She pulled my head down and kissed me. She tasted the same, felt the same. I love you, I whispered. I love you too, she replied, very much. Will you do this for me? I don't know if I can. I don't know if I want to. Smiling, she said, don't make me get tough with you. I was able to finally laugh. Okay, we'll try. Sit down and relax, she said. I need to talk with Hector. Close your eyes and enjoy the fire. I sat. The heat rolled over me, heavy and soothing. Drowsiness hit me like a wave. The last thing I saw was Callie on the floor beside Hector, rubbing him behind the ears and talking to him. I awoke, wrapped in a quilt. I looked around in confusion. An older man in a park ranger uniform came into view. There you are, he said. You gave me a scare. Where am I? Ranger station. Lucky for you, your dog came here and woke me up. He grabbed my arm and started pulling me. I took the snowmobile and followed him to you. You were pretty hypothermic when I found you. We were at a cabin, I said. He frowned. Cabin? That wasn't a cabin. It's just an old run-down shack that's been abandoned for at least 50 years. It's barely standing. You were lying face down in the snow outside it. Suddenly Hector was there, half climbing on me. That's a good dog you have, the ranger said. He saved your life. What were you doing out there? Hiking. It was supposed to be clear. He snorted. Weather people. Nice to have a job where you can be wrong all the time. He gestured at me. Now just relax. A plow is clearing the way for an ambulance. They should be here soon. I don't need an ambulance. Yes, you do. Hypothermia is no joke. I have to call someone to get Hector. I don't think you'll be in the hospital long. He can stay here. He and my husky get along. A month later, I was fully recovered. The ranger had been right. I had a good case of frostbite, and though painful, it didn't result in anything permanent. I was lucky. It also caused me to rethink calling Hector not the sharpest knife in the drawer. What he did was incredible. Look, I have no idea how I ended up like that. I know I saw, talked to, and kissed Callie, but I hear you. How is that even possible? The honest answer is I don't know. Maybe it happened, or maybe it was a hypothermic-induced hallucination. The only one who knows for sure has four legs and doesn't speak human. I asked him anyway. Hector gave me his most zen-like look, but I swear he was smiling. Either way, he's different now. He's back to the way he was before Callie died. While he still sleeps with one of her shirts, he doesn't look for her anymore. He's at peace and more zen than ever. I feel better, too. I don't know how it was possible, but I do know this. Callie didn't want us to struggle anymore. She had given us one last gift. Thank you, Callie. Your fur baby. And I love you. Porta Terra, Coming Home for the First Time by Michael Huff. Dreyfus stared through the portal he'd just opened, his heart seized by a sudden rush of fear. He could see a barren, rocky landscape backed by a stormy sky. Nothing to hang his hopes on. This was not one of those commercial gateways kept open for long stretches as tourists and travelers step between worlds. This was an emergency portal. It had the capacity for only a small group for a very short time. They had been distributed by the cadets. Four groups. A failsafe should everything go wrong. And everything that could go wrong had gone wrong. Over the last 46 hours, his group of 16 had dwindled by twos and threes until now it consisted of only one. The portal pack had been passed from one cadet to another as they each met their untimely death, picked off by a dying planet, unable to support anything more complex than a virus. The toxic air seared the lungs and was barely tolerable with a rebreather on. Water was nowhere to be found, at least within any reasonable distance from their drop point, or should that be their crash site. What was meant to be a routine first mission for a new cadre of graduating cadets, a final test of their training, had turned to a disaster of epic proportions, all because of Lieutenant Cadet Foreman, a true ass if ever there was one. He'd come from a family of Space Corps officers, and he behaved as though their achievements were his own. Dreyfus thought him completely pathetic. What was Foreman doing with the enlisted cadets if he were all that? Why wasn't he in officer training? To make matters worse, the CO had made him a cadet lieutenant, after which there was simply no living with him. If it hadn't been for the unspoken rule among cadets that Space Corp had each other's back, he'd have voiced it out right away. Instead, they covered for him, sometimes by ignoring his old orders, other times by taking the blame when things went wrong. Now, too late, Dreyfus saw the folly in that thinking. It would have been so much wiser to have let him hang himself and allow a new company leader to be selected. By covering for Foreman, he squeaked through, undetected by the instructors whose job was to sort out the bad apples. Instead, they all had paid the price. Dreyfus realized as he paused before the shimmering circle that the warp drive breaking was not Foreman's fault. It was everything that happened after, everything that led to the crash onto the surface of this restricted planet, and the death so far of 15 cadets, including Foreman. He shook himself and pulled to him as much equipment as he could. He tied a triple cord through the straps of most of the now dead cadets' backpacks. He couldn't budge the bundle when it included everyone's equipment, so he'd sorted through it, focusing primarily on food supplies, water, first aid, and weaponry. Shelter and communication gear in the personal flyers were simply too much weight and might or might not make that much difference in a survival situation. He'd dialed up no fewer than 6 different portals, each one more dismal than the last. They didn't have the power to reach very far, so it limited his selection. On top of that, he didn't have the power to pull up telemetry on each target to determine suitability. All he had was a visual and nothing more, that and a gut feeling. Then the unit indicated only enough power for this final window, and it was time to roll the dice. Win or lose, he had only the choice to stay or go. Staying was only an option if his intent were suicide. If he wanted any chance at all to live, stepping through this portal was his only hope. If it proved fatal, he was already dead. Anything else would be a win. The circle collapsed in on itself as Dreyfus pondered. He worked the dial and tapped the unit like he'd seen his father do with their atmosphere unit back home. It appeared to do the trick as the circle flicked back on, this time with a crackle and a bit of static. It was now or never. Dreyfus pulled on the harness he'd made with all the equipment he could carry attached and dragging across the ground. Then, bending low, he ran for the circle, aiming to haul it all through before the portal collapsed. He'd delayed so long he wasn't sure he'd make it through himself, let alone any of the survival gear. There was a charge of energy as he passed through, like a shock to your skin when the humidity is just right, and you touch your cat to pet it, a jolt of electricity, and then he stumbled forward, sprawling across the alien soil, having lost his footing on the uneven ground on this new planet. He'd fallen hard, bruising his shoulder, then struggled to regain his feet. He realized that gravity here was heavier than what he was used to, but not unbearable. The weight of his baggage train had likewise increased, and he realized that not all of the gear had cleared the portal. Though it still flickered severely, it remained open. For how long, Dreyfus had no idea. He began pulling on the cords that led back through the opening, pulling each backpack one by one. He'd gotten four more clear when the portal closed, leaving two leads cut off and one bag cut at about the two-thirds mark where the portal had been. All in all, not a bad haul. He wasn't yet sure what hadn't made it through, but between the backpacks and the duffels, he'd rescued the lion's share and felt his chances improved. Now to assess his new situation. The sky above was heavily clouded and shot through with reds, oranges, blues, purples, as though painted with great abandon. The ground, for as far as he could see in every direction, was dark, almost black, and very uneven. The sun hung just above the horizon, and he didn't know if it was rising or setting. Opposite the sun, the horizon was hazy, but he was almost certain mountains rose in the distance and stretched at great length in either direction. The air was breathable, with none of the searing bite he'd just left behind. It bore a musky and dank scent he could not identify. There were no plants in view, just the clumpy, disturbed-looking soil. A steady breeze blew in from the direction to the right of the sun. If the sun set shortly, he would call that direction north. It had a chill to it, suggesting he was right. There was nothing he could see that could be hastily turned into shelter, and he'd carried none with him. He made a quick decision to prepare for the worst. Digging through several backpacks, he found some hand tools, and he began to dig a trench, not deep, just enough to create a mound of soil in a line perpendicular to the wind. On top of it, he stacked the backpacks and duffel bags, curving them around in a short crescent, and sliding each layer out to overhang the bag below it. In this way, he quickly formed a small redoubt, a buffer against the wind. Then he began removing some of the impacted soil beneath the redoubt, carving out a slight hollow that if he pressed himself against the embankment, he could further increase his protection. When he finished, he found some rations, and taking it into his shelter, he huddled down and ate. As he did, rain began to fall from the sky, landing in big splotches at first, slowly but soon hitting faster and faster. Dreyfus stood for a moment, arms outstretched, letting the cool liquid splash against his face. He had never seen rain in his life, having grown up under a dome on a barren moon, then moving to a space station for university, and then to an asteroid for cadet training. It was glorious to behold this water, and he assumed it was water, raining down from the heavens. Slowly, he sank again to the ground and pressed against the wall of the redoubt. He didn't know what his chances for long-term survival were, but his hunch was about as long as the rations lasted. After that, who knew? But to die with the sun, the wind, and the rain on your face, who could ask for more? With that thought, he slept, even as the trench began to slowly fill up, too tired and too content to care. The Highest Mountain on Mars by Joseph Ellis. The Martian Award for Foolish Courage blends 10 ultralight metals in a spiral pendant, a lustrous rainbow of pearlescent gunmetal and comb. Clasped on a silken red ribbon, it is bestowed annually on those who best exemplify the founding principles of Martian society. Tenacity in the face of overwhelming odds, high tolerance for personal risk, and misplaced confidence. Every year, 10 recipients are invited to a ceremony atop Olympus Mons, the highest mountain in the solar system, to receive the award. It is the highest and lowest honor bestowed by the Martian Planetary Council. It is my job to polish and array these medals in preparation for the award ceremony in the Mars Museum's Grand Hall. What a way to employ a graphic design degree. I've already set up the glass case that will house the medals, made the purest clear crystal and so translucent that he felt cushions that I've already fluffed appeared inside to float. An hour remains before the council arrives each time, enough time to extract the awards from their leather bag, carefully clean them, and arrange them neatly in the case. I hoist the first medal. It really is quite light, a few dozen grams, not counting the ribbon. It's a thin wafer of light metal, tough as a penny and smooth as glass. You'd barely feel it if it fell on your head. I read the name lightly etched on the front face, Timothy Dibbins. I've read the stories for the winners. Timothy is a custodial worker in Insidious City, an older man who lives alone. One day, walking to work, he witnessed a pair of children fall through the ice at their famed geode pool. He ran to help, dove in, retrieved one child, but found his muscles paralyzed with cold trying to save the other. Fortunately, rescue workers managed to pull both of them to safety. Unfortunately, Timothy suffered nerve damage and struggles to walk now, and the pragmatic commentators noted the children likely would have lived even without his intervention, that he should have followed the age-old wisdom to never jump into freezing water to try to save someone. I pull my hover palette closer and select it from a micro brush and jeweler's loop. I whisk away tiny particles of dust from Timothy's award, spritz it lightly with sparkling polish, then center it on its velvety seat. Mr. Dibbins' award is soon joined by one for Lillian Ankh, an Army corporal who dove on a defective grenade to save her comrades who had all taken cover behind a bulkhead wall. Then one for Strom Jerichs, a baseball outfielder known for his intense style of play, who broke his collarbone on a sprinting drive in the final inning of an 8-0 game. Then one for Strom Jerichs, then one for Daredevil Drummond, who bungee jumped into the caldera of Olympus Mons, a terrifying record drop into that legendary 3-kilometer indentation. She was unconscious by the time her assistants pulled her to safety, but she set the record for the highest bungee jump ever recorded. I can see my distorted reflection in the shiny metal as I work. My small bespectacled blue eyes look like tiny crystals. My mother always said I had Nana's shining eyes and Grandpa's pug nose. As a child, I couldn't decide if she was insulting me or them. Now I can see a certain balance to those features. I take a brief break to walk along the Grand Hall of the Olympus Museum. I approach the front windows overlooking the Titanic slope down the tallest mountain humankind has ever found, an impossible 15 miles high and 350 miles in diameter, stretching off into the hazy pastel yellow sky of mid-morning on Mars, a vast red plain forever falling away. I've been on this mountain many times, my home planet's most famous landmark. I've looked over that ledge thousands of times. I've not yet gotten used to it. Tourists from Earth or Jupiter's moons often claim that Mars is ugly, everywhere red, everywhere dusty and hazy, hardly any greenery or flowers or bodies of water, despite centuries of terraforming. They claim it smells like corroded nails here. They still refer to Martian civilization as the Great Mistake, the first and most pointlessly colonized planet. We Martians are stereotyped as hardy fools, defying the odds and good sense in building lives on this inhospitable rusty rock. From this vantage point, I can see the hover tracks running up the eastern slope. The delegation must be on the mountain already, as the fastest level terrain takes 2 hours to scan Olympus Mons. I mentally trace the tracks till I see the distant vehicle, a tiny silver line moving amongst the maroon landscape. I turn my gaze to the right to the great mountains of the Tharsis Plateau, Archias, Pavonis, Arcia, all peeking out through the haze, endlessly distant, but so huge they're still visible. You can see forever on Mars. though the ever-present dust in the air makes everything appear hazy, soft, cozy. Mars isn't ugly. Plain, perhaps. Lacking variety, maybe. But in that stark red infinity, I can find beauty enough. After a lifetime here, you learn to distinguish the many shades of brick red and ruddy brown, and no other world features such a colorful set of skylines, depending upon the time of day. Cayenne, pastel pink, canary yellow. Looking at those beautiful skies as a child inspired me to pursue the graphic arts, and now I polish and prepare major awards, so things worked out okay. And it's so quiet up here. I think as I return to the glass case, Mars must be the most peaceful of the colonized worlds, and that goes double this high in the atmosphere. I can just barely hear the low hum of the museum's oxygenators, heaters, and acclimatizers, the ubiquitous devices that make life possible. I unpack the rest of the awards, including ones for an industrial whistleblower who thought his company's losses hid embezzlement. Turned out the company was just poorly run. Another award would go to a comedian who performed a monologue critical of his crowd of wealthy arms dealers. His set was courageous, but a bit of a comic dud. As I work, I think about how my maternal grandmother won this award about 50 years ago. She was a demolition engineer who accidentally trapped herself and half her crew in a titanium mine, then freed them all with a risky controlled explosion. Most award winners feel ambivalent about the honor, but still accept it for the free vacation and cash prize. But my Nana showed her medal off every chance she got. She even left me the award in her will, hoping it would inspire me to take chances in life. I sold it online to help pay my student loans. I'm a bad granddaughter. I take my time polishing each medal, enjoying every tiny tool from my hover palette, including an extendable nano brush for precise cleaning at a distance. Sometimes it's easier to notice imperfections from a steeper angle. As I work, I imagine the magnetized Levitrain pulling into the museum station and the dignitaries emerging. They enter the long hall just as I finish up. They nod in my direction, acknowledging our shared community as the hardy fools of Mars. It's an indulgent thought, but it makes me smile. In this reverie and workflow, I only subconsciously note that the sounds around me have changed. In between the low buzz of the oxygenators and acclimatizers, another pitch emerged, one similar enough that I didn't notice how odd it is. This sound is muffled by insulation, but appears strongest, coming from the direction of the western windows. Wind rarely reaches the top of Olympus Mons, typically content to buffet the high cliffs that form its skirt. But occasionally a jet stream gets trapped in a gully and shoots perfectly up the ledge. I couldn't tell you what conditions need to conspire for a prolonged gust to reach this high. But that's what happened. There was some warning. I even perked my head up moments before the western window flung open, its strained joints buckling at the sudden force. The wind sent my hair billowing all about my face, and through that dark mass I could see a tiny round shape trailing a red ribbon flit past me. I turned to see the eastern window shift on its hinges, opening just slightly in the middle, and that tiny trailing silken ribbon slipped through, taking its ultralight metal award with it. It felt like something out of a cartoon. One of the awards, the final one, had flown free and out of the museum. I found myself paralyzed, wondering what I should do. The wind had lessened, but a light breeze pervaded the hall. I ran to the western window, forced it closed, and reset all the latches. One of the hinges was damaged, but should hold. Next, I sprinted to the eastern window. I've never felt so slow, and gazed out into the midday sun. That red ribbon should be easy to pick out. So much brighter in color than Olympus's darker shades or the pastel yellow sky, but I didn't notice it until I inclined my head. The award floated like a kite. It must be soaring 100 feet off the ground. I watched it float, wondering if it would simply soar until it left Mars entirely. I followed its arc lower and lower, but also further away.
Perhaps you can guess where it landed, though. Land is a bit of a misnomer. The award floated to the Levitrain tracks, then stuck in the air above one of the rails, captured by the track's powerful magnetic field. My mind swam. Should I run to tell a security guard? What would happen if the train hit that floating bit of metal on the tracks? I tried to recall my high school chemistry and physics classes, the interaction of the elements, magnetism, electric fields. I could recall nothing relevant, but something from an old safety lesson stuck in my mind. Do not come within a foot of active hover tracks. The magnetic field is dangerous. But if I left the award there, would it mess with the magnetic field? Might such a disruption crash the train? Subconsciously, I knew what I would do. I would take a foolish risk to save an award that celebrates foolish risk. The potential irony would have made O. Henry or M.K. Shyamalan scoff. I retreated to grab something from my work area, then made for the museum entrance. In a pinch, a hover pallet can support a human weight for an extended distance, particularly on a downward slope. The technology is not so different from the hoverboards we used to glide down Martian dunes when we were children. It would be more difficult to keep my balance, but the distance wasn't so far, and the grade of the slope wasn't too daunting. I made a running start, leapt, and placed my trusted pallet under my feet. I held the pallet with my right hand and stuck my left arm out for balance. Together we careened down the slope in the rough direction of that little red silken spot hovering over the tracks. I could steer ever so slightly by shifting my weight, but if I fell, I might roll down that slope a mile and scuff myself up badly, but it was too late to turn back. I won't draw out the suspense. Somehow this cockamamie plan worked. As I passed the tracks, the electromagnetic field shocked the soles of my feet. Luckily, I had enough momentum to soar past, hooking the ribbon with the extendable nano brush. Seconds later, the train sped by. I hadn't even realized how close it was. I tumbled onto the opposite ridge, where I lay shaking, wanting to laugh, but forced to control my breathing in the low oxygen. I was vaguely aware of the metallic thrumming sound as the train rumbled to a stop. They'd clearly noticed me zip past. Medical personnel emerged to check that I was all right, then invited me aboard to travel the last few minutes back to the museum. And in that acclimatized cabin, surrounded by planetary counselors and other dignitaries, staring at me with wondering faces, I couldn't help but giggle. I was feeling lightheaded. Cut me some slack. Eventually, one counselor, an elderly woman with stately thick gray eyebrows, asked me who I was and why I'd put on such a daredevil stunt. I'd explain as well as I could, stopping occasionally to catch my breath. I really never do things like this. I'm a graphic designer. I was setting up the honors case when that platform wind snatched the final award and whisked it away. Your balance was impeccable. I've always loved the idea of balance. Can't say as much for your sense. I worried the metal would mess with the magnetic field. I thought you might be in danger. You think that little thing could harm a hover train? Does sound foolish, doesn't it? And your name? The counselor's tone was cool, but she placed a warm hand on mine. Veronica James. James? Not related to Diabolic James, the infamous explosion queen. Yes, she was my grandmother. I can't keep the deflation from my voice as I recall the fate of Nana's cherished award. When you did out there, embodied the spirit of this annual ceremony, that's likely what inspired me. You know, we have the prerogative to add award winners, even at this late date. Counselor smiles warmly at me as we pull into the museum station. I return her smile. If they give me an award, I'll wear it proudly.